I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. On this edition of Parallax Views, the Green Party of the United States is often written off as a spoiler in the U.S. presidential elections every 4 years. The accusation is that the Green Party and its progressive politics gets in the way of the Democratic Party's presidential efforts by siphoning off votes. But what's the other side of the story? Is there a case to be made for third-party politics? And, moreover, what are the ideals of the Green Party itself that often gets lost in the discussion, which, as stated earlier, usually centers around whether or not the Green Party is a spoiler in the U.S. presidential elections? Well, hopefully, this edition of Parallax Views will provide some answers to those and other questions. As 2020 Green Party presidential candidate Howie Hawkins joins us to discuss his run for the presidency under the Green Party ticket, how he hopes that his efforts will help build the base of the Green Party at the local level, and giving his thoughts on what he passionately and adamantly refers to as the life or death issues facing the United States today. Whatever your preconceptions may be about the Green Party, Howie is a noted activist and organizer. In fact, he played a major role in the original Green New Deal. Long before the Green New Deal of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And he has rather thoughtful, nuanced takes on a number of issues, including policing, military spending, the opioid crisis, environmentalism and ecology, and income inequality. So I think that you're going to find this to be a fascinating conversation. Leave those preconceptions at the door, folks, as Green Party presidential candidate Howie Hawkins joins us on this edition of Parallax Views. Welcome to Parallax Views, Green Party presidential candidate, Howie Hawkins. How are you doing, Howie?
I'm doing good, thank you. It's good to be here.
So, Howie, I wanted to have you on the program, especially in light of Bernie Sanders dropping out of the Democratic presidential race. Bernie supporters are really hungry for another candidate outside of the Biden sort of Trump binary. Maybe for my listeners that aren't as clued in about the Green Party, maybe you could tell them what the Green Party is all about, because I think we're given this narrative in the mainstream media of, oh, the Green Party, they're the spoilers that cost Al Gore the election. And I think that's not necessarily a fair representation.
No, we're trying to represent the people that aren't represented by the two corporate parties. You know, some of the things Bernie Sanders was supporting, we've long supported. And it's clear after Sanders' second attempt to get it into the Democratic Party, they're not going to let it get in. You know, that somebody said, and I think this is really accurate, the Democrats let progressives give speeches, but the corporatists make the decisions. And in fact, there's utility to having an AOC or a Bernie Sanders speak in the Democratic Party because it draws progressives into the Democratic Party. And then when they vote for a centrist like Biden, they get lost in the sauce. Nobody knows what that vote stands for. They don't know you're a Sanders socialist or a Biden corporatist. A vote for the Green Party, it's real clear. We're for a lot of things Bernie Sanders was for. Medicare for all, a full-strength Green New Deal, medical and student debt relief, college for all, a job guarantee, and all those good things. So if you want to keep fighting for those things, you know, the Green Party is the way to go.
And I do want to give you a chance to respond to that common accusation of the whole spoiler candidate thing. I know Bill McKibben was making comments recently saying, oh, Howie should drop out. This election's too important. I want to be able to give you a chance to respond because I think the criticism is unfair in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it's not us spoiling the elections. It's the Democrats. I have a response to Bill McKibben that'll be in Counterpunch this coming week. But my basic point is what he said was I should drop out, at least in the so-called battleground states, and work for ranked choice voting. And of course, if the Green Party, which has been giving this nonpartisan proven solution to the Democrats since the Nader campaign 20 years ago, and they've never taken it up, if we're not in a race, it won't be raised. We think we need to replace the Electoral College with a ranked choice national popular vote for president. All the Republicans in the 21st century that got to the presidency first got there when they lost the popular vote. It was the Electoral College that put them in office, not the Green Party. So the Democrats, instead of going after the real target, pick on the Green Party. And I think that spoils the election. I'll tell you another thing. My experience is when Greens are in close two-party races between Democrats and Republicans, we improve the Democrat. Because without us in the race, the Democrat tends to go to the middle and try to, you know, sound like Republican light and get those voters in the middle, and they lose their base. When a Green is in the race raising progressive issues, the Democrats got to respond. And suddenly they sound a lot better, and their base comes back to them. So, you know, if Biden loses to this fool in the White House now, you know, who, I mean, he's a childlike dummy. You know, go drink Clorox. Stick ultraviolet light up your ass. I don't know what he's got in mind, but, I mean, this fool, everybody can see it. And, you know, Biden, he's got the megaphone. He's got the platform. He's the presumptive Democratic nominee. And where is he? I mean, is he on a park bench somewhere feeding breadcrumbs to pigeons? I mean, it makes me as angry about him as Trump, because he should be responding right now, because Trump is a total disaster. He's killing us. So if we're not in the race, issues won't get raised, including ranked choice voting. And the idea that we should only run in so-called safe states, that's like saying we don't take ourselves seriously enough to really compete for all the votes. I mean, why should somebody support us if we don't support ourselves? And the other thing is, and this is what I wrote in response to, you know, Michael Albert and Noam Chomsky and Barbara Ehrenreich and those people that told me to run a safe state strategy. Every state is a battleground for the Green Party. Take Ohio and Pennsylvania. They're fracking the hell out of those states. They're building pipelines to build a petrochemical plastics complex in Appalachia, as if that's what we need. And even the Democratic electeds that support Bernie Sanders won't come out against fracking. So the Green Party is why we need there. That's a battleground for us. We find the Democrats are on the other side on so many issues, you know, from the Iraq war to affordable housing today.
I was going to say in this regard that when it comes to this idea of the spoiler candidate, I don't understand that, because to me, Al Gore lost in 2000, not because of Ralph Nader, but because of the Electoral College and ultimately the Supreme Court. Often, I don't think it's the Green Party's fault. It's just very odd to me.
Well, another thing about Florida is 308,000 Democrats voted for Bush. And the Democrats, instead of worrying about the Green Party, they should worry about their own base because they're losing it. And a lot of that has to do with those economic class issues where the Democrats, you know, the Democrats and Republicans, they fight over the cultural issues. You know, God, guns, gays, abortion, and especially race, although it's not explicit, it's dog whistles. But when it comes to the economic class issues and foreign policy, it's neoliberal economics and neoconservative foreign policy. And that's where the two parties come together. So, you know, when working and middle-class people that are struggling hear the Democratic message, they can't tell it from the Republican message on those economic issues, those bread and butter issues that, you know, people put at the top of their list. It's always, now it's healthcare, it's jobs, it's economic security. And the Democrats' message has just not, you know, reached those people. So some of them who are culturally conservative vote for Republicans. The Green Party had nothing to do with that. You know, that's the Democrats' problem.
And it's telling that the presumptive nominee for the Democratic Party is like an old school segregationist who still supports the Hyde Amendment. Like, even about these cultural issues, they really aren't that far to the left.
Yeah, and when you look at how the Democrats have moved, say, on gay marriage, they had their finger to the wind. You know, they evolved, as Obama said, on that issue with the public. What moved the dial on that question was the movement, you know, saying we want marriage equality, and efforts like we had a Green Party mayor and vice mayor or deputy mayor start marrying people in New Paltz, New York in 2003. And the Democratic Attorney General at the time, Elliot Spitzer, got an injunction against them, and all the Democrats were opposed to it. And by 2011, we had legalized gay marriage. And even the, you know, the nonprofit industrial complex gay rights groups were saying, oh, we're going to start a backlash. But once people started thinking about it, you know, why not? You know, why should we, you know, ration love? So the people moved, and then the politicians moved behind them. And you're right, the Democrats have always been behind on those issues, like civil rights. You know, they had this coalition between, you know, the northern union-based sort of populist economic Democrats in the north and the Dixiecrats in the south, who tended to be more populist on economics but segregationist on race. And it took the civil rights movement to, you know, force the Democrats, because they realized, you know, they were now dependent a lot on the black vote and they had to, you know, move. But they're always behind the curve.
That actually brings me to another issue I wanted to touch on with you. And that's, there's a lot of talk now about identity politics and how it relates to class. I think some people on the left feel that there's too much focus on identity politics. At the same time, I think we can't ignore issues like racism. I mean, we're going to need a multiracial coalition if we want a broad-based class movement.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, identity politics is a mixed bag. You have people organizing around their identities because they're oppressed and they're fighting their oppression. And that's good. And then you have, you know, Trump white identity politics, which is mobilizing around keeping white people in a privileged position. And that's bad. And then when you get to the people fighting oppression, you sort of have a left and a right version of that. The right version is the Democratic Party version. They want diversity, but not equality. They want a few black faces in high places, a few women up there. But for the masses of people, women are still paid less than men. Majority of black people are suffering. But that's okay, because they sort of have this meritocratic ideology, which appeals to the professional managerial middle class, which is the mass base of the Democratic Party. Working class people vote in low numbers because they don't feel either party, you know, really cares about them. So people say they're apathetic. I think they're alienated. So we need identity politics dealing with these kinds of oppression that's about equality and not just diversity. And you can't have class unity if you're divided by race, gender, and geography, occupational divisions, and all those things. We gotta deal with those problems, which are, you can organize around identity, but it's not in competition with class politics. In fact, it's necessary to working class political unity.
Now, if we could, maybe we could get a little bit into your background, how you became involved in organizing and politics. I know you come from a working class background. I really appreciate that. Maybe we could talk just a little bit about your story.
Sure. You know, actually, my dad was a lawyer, you know, GI Bill after World War II. I, you know, middle class background, but I came up with working class people. Mm-hmm. And within my family, I mean, as a child, as I headed for elementary school, I had a set of cousins who were the children of one of the first Japanese war brides in the military, and they're stationed in Virginia. And then there was another set of white cousins who had lost the farm in Indiana, which had been in the family for a long time, and bought a bed and breakfast in Virginia. And I heard that my Asian cousins are going to the colored schools and my white cousins are going to be sent to the white schools. And even as a child going in elementary school, I knew that was wrong. I imagined, you know, in my own neighborhood, how bad that would be to go to different schools. I just knew it was wrong. And then I got into elementary school and they had us diving under our desks, putting our, you know, hands over our head in case of a nuclear war. I, you know, as a child, I knew that wasn't going to protect us, you know, and I'm wondering, you know, what's wrong with these adults? Why don't they get rid of the nukes? Why don't they let us go to school together? So, you know, I sort of was questioning things then. And then I'm 12 years old and I see, you know, racial justice was a big issue for me. It was a family issue. And I see Ronald Reagan leading the Republicans in a referendum to repeal the Fair Housing Law that had just passed. And they succeeded. And I saw the Democrats seat the Dixiecrats from Mississippi instead of the Mississippi Freedom Democrats. And so I was asking, where's my party? And it's the 60s, and I'm coming into my teenage years. There's a lot going on. Civil rights and the anti-war movement after Johnson got elected and escalated massively. And so 1968 was my first party, the Peace and Freedom Party. Peace in Vietnam, freedom was a civil rights slogan. And I was committed from that time on that we need a people's party, a party for the regular folks that was committed to real democracy, democratic socialism, and ecology. And so I supported Peace and Freedom. Although I couldn't vote for it, I was rooting for it. And, you know, jawboning adults that would listen to me, I was probably pestering them. And then in 72, we got the voting age lowered. I could vote for Ben Spock for the People's Party, of which Peace and Freedom was affiliated, again in 76. And then Barry Commoner, Citizens Party, 1980. He was the big environmental scientist at the time. And then I got invited to the first national organizing meeting for a Green Party because I was a member of the Clamshell Alliance, had helped organize that. We did a massive occupation of the Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant site in 1977. 1,414 of us arrested. They locked us up at National Guard armories for 10 days. And the anti-nuclear movement, you know, went national after that. So my message to that meeting was we can't build a political party out of a presidential campaign. We got to go out and organize locally, get involved in local politics and build from the bottom up. And the Greens proceeded to do that. So by 1996, when Ralph Nader was willing to let us use his name, he didn't actively campaign, but use his name, we got him on over 30 ballots. And that laid the basis for his run in 2000, which put us on the national map. Mm-hmm. So I stayed involved with the Green Party, and the Greens in New York have run me statewide four times against Hillary Clinton in 2006. And the issues then were single-payer health care, the war in Iraq, climate change, life or death issues. And then they ran me for governor 2010, 2014, 2018. We got enough votes to get on the ballot for the next election cycle. In 2010, I was the first candidate in this country to campaign for a Green New Deal, which was a program to get us out of the Great Recession with an economic bill of rights and a massive investment in clean energy. And in 2014, we got 5%, which really changed the politics in New York on some issues. You know, Andrew Cuomo wanted to get more votes than his father got in when he was running, more votes than Andrew Cuomo got when he first elected in 2010. He wanted to run up the vote to get ready to run for president. And he got less votes. And we're sitting there with 5%. And he ended up adopting four things that he had never supported. A ban on fracking, $15 minimum wage, paid family leave, and tuition-free higher education. Now, the latter didn't really happen. He has a little scholarship program that hardly anybody can take advantage of. But the point is, he couldn't take us for granted. So that's how I got from a little kid kind of wondering what the hell are these adults doing to where I am today.
What is the secret, or what do you think the secret is to successful organizing and sort of making these pushes for substantive policy changes? What do you think has been successful in the past?
Well, I think you need a combination of social movements, raising the demand, organizing people, mobilizing people, and an independent alternative on the ballot. So those movements aren't taken for granted if they're progressive movements by the Liberal Party, which has been a Republic, the Democrats recently, you know, in the 19th century coming out of the Civil War, it was the Republicans. And in response to that, you know, the Greenback Labor Party and People's Party were organized. And if you look at American history, going back to the Working Men's Party, the first labor party in the world in 1829 and 30, the Liberty Party against slavery, through the populist parties and the socialist party, for 100 years, these independent left parties set the agenda. They put slavery on the agenda. They put women's right to vote on the agenda. They put anti-monopoly and public ownership of utilities on the agenda. They put social insurance programs, the New Deal adopted, on the agenda, and they were eventually adopted. So that's been the historic role. And I think what we've been missing since the 30s is most of the left has gone into the Democratic Party and tried to, you know, win reforms through then. And the New Deal coalition, you know, looked pretty good and they got some reforms. But since the 1970s, the New Deal Democrats were replaced by the corporate New Democrats, as Bill Clinton called them. And the left keeps beating its head against that brick wall and getting defeated. And so I think what's been missing is, you know, the left realizing we need our own party with its own identity, its own voice, its alternative program. And instead of trying to push it through these Democratic politicians, it's like political ventriloquism. You're trying to get them to say and do what you want, and you don't have much leverage. We should go directly to the people and speak to them. And then I'd make another comment on that question, is that activists need to become organizers. In other words, you know, activists, the Green Party is full of activists. Most of them are pissed off former Democrats. You know, they got mad about the Iraq War, or they've been fighting the Democratic machine on affordable housing, whatever it is, fracking. And that, you know, they're the kind of person that will write a leaflet and go to the community that's not involved yet and say, join us and preach, instead of what a union organizer or a community organizer does. They go and listen and they find out how they can help, and they build relationships and trust. And if we're going to have an independent party on the left, we got to be a palpable presence in the communities now that are not voting in, you know, sufficient numbers, working class communities, communities of color, youth. And we got to build that relationship. So that's what I've been talking to, you know, Greens as we go through this campaign about learning how to do. It's not something we can do in, you know, the next 6 months of a campaign. It's something we got to, you know, get good at as we go through the next few years. But, you know, one more point is, you know, I still believe we got to build this party from the bottom up. So the question is, well, why am I running for president? And one reason is, about 40 to 50 states, the vote we get or the coattails we provide for another candidate like Secretary of State determines whether we have a ballot line for the next election cycle. And having a ballot line makes it a lot easier for our candidates to run. And we should be, to build this thing from the bottom up, be electing thousands of people to local and state and Congress as we go into the 2020s. And as we get more people in office, then psychologically it becomes easier to think, well, the Greens can win because they've won. So I think, you know, that's the path forward, and why, you know, I'm running for president, but I'm really running to build a movement and a party.
You know, I wanted to stick on that point for a second, because one of the things that I've found very exciting about your campaign is that I think it has a lot of potential to build the green movement on local and regional levels, as in getting Congress people in office that belong to the Green Party. And I think we can put a lot of attention on, you know, young and, you know, very hungry Green Party members that are actively wanting to do things. I don't think it's just about the presidential election itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And when I say we can elect thousands, I really believe that. We have 129 elected officials right now, which is as many as any, well, more than any party on the left since the heyday of the Socialist Party. The thing is, there are 500,000 offices up for election in this country. So we're just a drop in the bucket. And in most jurisdictions, they're one party jurisdictions. In rural America, it's Republican. In cosmopolitan America, it's Democratic. And the minor party in those jurisdictions, Democrats in rural areas, Republicans in urban areas, in most districts, they don't run serious campaigns. So a Green Party candidate, by raising serious issues and having a well-organized campaign, becomes the second party right away. And they can start a debate on the issues. And getting the debate going is half the battle, because, you know, take Medicare for All. You know, that's something where even the Republicans want to, you know, they support it because we won the argument on that. And I think that's how we build this party from the bottom up. And there are other jurisdictions where, you know, it's one party because of gerrymandering, but in a lot of places, they're begging for people to run for some of these offices, or people are running without any opposition. So I think there's a lot of opportunity. And these, you know, young people that, you know, they're mad about the future disappearing because of climate change, or their own economic future disappearing because, you know, the opportunities and prospects are low. You know, there's lots of opportunities for them to run for office.
Casey, if you want to chime in at all, I know you were really excited about doing this interview, so I wanted to give you a chance to talk to Howie a little bit.
Yeah, I get the impression that this kind of energy, this kind of focus of electoral strategy around not necessarily attempting to win the presidency, although if that happens, that'd be nice, but in trying to use this national campaign as a platform to get people elected at the local and regional level is something that the Sanders campaign has in many ways failed to do. I think that's a fair criticism to level at either the campaign staff's feet or at Sanders' feet himself. I guess it really doesn't matter. I guess just thank you for running. Thank you for raising these issues. It's kind of depressing to know the Democrats haven't been able to do anything meaningful and have more or less coalesced around the corporatist candidate. So I think at this point, disgruntled Bernie-crats, if I may call them that, should be orienting around the Green Party at this point. I think this is not really a question, more of a statement, but I think the Democrats have proven themselves for the past 20 years that they're not going to move to the left unless they're forced to do so.
And the Green Party, obviously, I think, plays a role in pushing politics to the left. You know, I wanted to get your thoughts on this, Howie. I'm supportive of the efforts of an AOC or Ilhan Omar or even a Bernie Sanders, but I don't think that means we can't support the Green Party as well. I think you can be very supportive of the Green Party, even if you like a politician like Ocasio-Cortez or what Bernie Sanders has tried to do with his campaign.
Yeah, I agree. You know, a lot of times people like that, you know, say we're spoilers, is just like, you know, the Biden people do. And I think they should realize we're actually their best allies, because with us out there, they don't get taken for granted inside the Democratic Party. You know, when we both raise Medicare for All, for example, we're on the outside. And if the Democrats like Biden don't talk about it, they're going to lose votes to the Green Party. So that gives leverage to the AOCs and the Rashida Tlaibs and the Ilhan Omars and the Bernie Sanders. So, you know, I have not shamed or scolded Greens who switched their registration to vote for Bernie Sanders. I can understand that because we're in a crisis. Bernie had a serious Green New Deal, unlike any of the other Democratic presidential candidates. He kept hitting on Medicare for All when all them first came out for it and then retreated, you know, like Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren. And actually Bernie did yesterday. I don't know if you heard that interview, but he said, I'll accept Medicare to 55 and for the kids, and then we'll have a public option for the rest. I mean, that's the problem when you go in the party. Bernie wants to be relevant. He's a senator. He's got to work with those people. But now he's compromising his positions. And so I was really sorry to see that. But in any case, to the extent he's still for Medicare for All, we're his best allies, because we're you know, championing that and saying, you know, that's the solution to this insane situation. I mean, we come into this coronavirus crisis, and because of profit-oriented healthcare, we're running a lean operation. They don't have excess capacity in case of a pandemic or some other emergency. And suddenly they're short of hospital beds in hospitals. Here in New York, we've lost 41 hospitals in the last two decades.
You know, I know. I was going to say in Philadelphia, which we're, my co-host and I are about 4 hours from Philadelphia, there's a shortage of hospitals because they shut down hospitals in poorer areas because they weren't viable, quote unquote. I mean, it's a huge problem, and it's due to these, I would say, neoliberal policies we've had for over 40 years now.
Exactly. And it's bipartisan. I mean, just taking the New York example, it was started by a Republican president named George Pataki. And then when Andrew Cuomo was elected, he took the guy that headed the commission that recommended these hospital closings and put him on his Medicaid restructuring team, which recommended cuts to Medicaid, which happened. And then they had another Medicaid restructuring team coming into this budget. And under the cover of the coronavirus crisis, where Andrew Cuomo's doing his daily briefings, compared to Trump, he looks like a genius. But meanwhile, he got more cuts to Medicaid, and he tripled the requirements for third parties to get on a ballot. So I call him the austerity autocrat. And tell Democrats, if you think you want to substitute him for Joe Biden, be careful what you wish for.
Well, I think that's very true. I think people have found something in Cuomo in the sense that, oh, well, he's so much better than this Trump guy. But when you really look at his record, he's not, you know, pro-worker or anything like that. I think it's very spotty at best.
No, most of my 5% came from public workers in New York State, because Cuomo set up another tier for pensions, put them on furlough, fought them on their wage and benefits and the contracts, and cut or was resisting increases to education and health funding, which are the two biggest items in the budget. So they were mad as hell at him. And in 2014, a lot of them, you know, voted for me. And yeah, it's like between, if it was Cuomo and Trump, it's the choice between a technocratic neoliberal and a total incompetent. And I guess you could say a technocratic neoliberal is the lesser evil, but it's not a solution, you know, to these underlying problems of, you know, a healthcare system that spends 30% of its money on paperwork, figuring out, you know, if you're covered and whether the insurance company will pay it. And, you know, that is a total overhead and a waste. And that, you know, they say capitalism is more efficient, not in delivering healthcare. So, Cuomo has opposed our, you know, single payer bill in New York. So, and there's another story there that I think people worth knowing about, is that New York is the fourth state where Democrats in the lower house were for a single payer bill at the state level. In New York, it goes back to 1992. And repeatedly they voted for it. And they kept saying, well, the Republicans block us because the state Senate was controlled by Republicans. Well, in 2018, the Democrats got the state Senate. And since then, the Democrats in the assembly won't vote for that single payer bill. Mm-hmm. And we had similar situations in Hawaii, California, and Vermont. You know, when it's politically expedient and popular, they'll say they're for Medicare for All. But when they really got to do it, and those lobbyists and those campaign contributions start coming in from the health insurance industry and the drug companies, they get cold feet.
You know, I think it's interesting. I like that you have used the term in other interviews, and I think you said it briefly in this conversation, use the term life or death issues. And I think we really are at a moment, especially during this pandemic, where people are realizing these political problems are life or death issues. What do you think the biggest issues are in terms of those life or death issues?
Well, obviously climate. And people sometimes think, oh, it's more severe storms and more heat waves and they can handle it. But it's really about mass species extinctions, ecosystem collapse, which means agriculture collapses. And so there are climate scientists who try to calculate this out. And the ability of us to grow food may mean 90% of us, of the number of people we have now, will not be around in the year 2100. I mean, that's the kind of calamity we're facing. So that's obviously a life and death issue, and that's what my Green New Deal is about. Inequality is a life or death issue. It's killing us. The life expectancies of the working class in this country have been declining. Average life expectancy in this country has declined over the last 4 years. The life expectancy gap between our richest and poorest counties is now 20 years. So they call them deaths of despair because, you know, sometimes it's people, they got to choose between rent and going to the doctor. And they don't go to the doctor. The man that lived downstairs from where I'm sitting right now, a year ago, last April, he decided instead of getting the kidney medicine that, you know, Medicaid told him he needed to get but didn't pay for, he was going to pay his winter utility bill and get square away with that. And by mid-April, his kidneys failed, and he was dead. And then you have that kind of situation, and then you got people in despair turning to opioids and other, you know, alcohol and obesity. I mean, there's a lot of things that happen when people are struggling and they, you know, try to cope with other mechanisms. And that's why.
I just wanted to comment on that really quick. So my co-host Casey and I are in Pennsylvania, and the opioid epidemic is really, it's really bad here. And I've been to gas stations here where they have blue lights in the bathrooms, so people can't they can't shoot up on these drugs. And I just think to myself, we need to do something about this. And it just feels like we're not doing anything. And it's an issue that is very close to my heart. I think we need to address it at some point as a country. So I'm glad you brought up the opioid epidemic.
Yeah, and like it needs to go beyond like creating hostile architecture or putting blue lights in bathrooms or all these band-aids over what are deep systemic issues.
Yeah, well, I'll take a tangent on the opioid crisis and the health crisis from drug abuse. It should be treated as a health problem, not a criminal problem. So for marijuana, I think it should be legal, regulated, and taxed because marijuana is less harmful than alcohol and tobacco, which are legal. For the harder drugs, I think we should do what Portugal did. They decriminalized possession for personal use. And instead of getting a criminal charge that could send you to jail, you get a violation like a jaywalking or a parking ticket. And you show up to a hearing with a doctor, a lawyer, and a social worker. And they look at your situation and see, you know, why are you taking drugs? Do you need a job? Do you need drug treatment? Do you need to talk to somebody, you know, counseling? And they help people. And they instituted this in 2001, and overdoses have practically disappeared. Crimes related to the drug trade have practically disappeared. And actually, less people are using those hard drugs now because their life got stabilized and the drug is a crutch they didn't want anymore. Or they got treatment and, you know, were able to find a way to cope without that drug. And so I think that's what we need to do. I mean, throwing people in prison and filling up the prisons. I mean, right now, life and death issue for them is not drugs. It's coronavirus. They're in close quarters. They're getting sick. And we set them up like they're in a petri dish. It's, you know, I've heard figures as high as 75% of the people now in prisons and jails could be released with no danger to public safety. A lot of them are awaiting trial on, you know, nonviolent charges. A lot of them are too old to do any damage. They've been in there too long because we punish longer than most countries for, you know, a lot of these crimes. Nonviolent drug offenders and so forth. That should just be a public safety matter. So anyway, that's the deal. That, you know, the drug crisis is a life or death issue. But what I was getting at with inequality is, you know, the Economic Bill of Rights we're talking about. A job guarantee. You get a public job if you can't find a private job. An income guarantee above poverty, built into the tax structure. So if your income is below the poverty line, the government sends you money to bring you above the poverty line. Above the poverty line, you pay taxes on a progressive basis. Housing. We need to build a lot more public housing because the private market is not covered it. And we need to do it the right way, like they do in Europe. It's not just for poor people, which increases segregation, which is the way we did it in this country. They have professionals, blue-collar workers, low-income people, all living in the same developments. And we need to do that to make sure everybody's got affordable housing. Comprehensive health care, that's Medicare for all. Lifelong public education, from pre-K and child care through post-secondary colleges, universities, technical and trade schools, and continuing adult education. in a secure retirement. And there, I just want to double Social Security benefits. This proposal has been around for about 10 years, written up in The Atlantic and published in a book by a guy named Stephen Hill. And the boomers raise their families while wages have been stagnant since 1973, actually a dollar less of the hourly wage now in real terms. And housing, healthcare, and college for the kids went through the roof. So they don't have savings. So people ought to be able to retire. And so that's the economic bill of rights. The third life or death issue I'm emphasizing is this new nuclear arms race, which no presidential candidate in any party is talking about. And we've got out of all these treaties, you know, the North Korea framework, the intermediate range forces, the Iran treaty, and now the last bilateral treaty between the United States and Russia, the New START treaty affecting strategic arms, expires next February 5th, and there's no negotiations going on between Trump and Putin. You know, they issued a joint statement yesterday about the spirit of the Elbe, you know, back in World War II, but they didn't say they're going back to negotiate an arms treaty. And meanwhile, both sides are modernizing their forces. The strategic arms are six times faster, hypersonic, which means you don't have 20 minutes to launch on warning and figure out if the warning is real. You got to launch when you think, before you think the other side is going to launch, which makes it a lot more dangerous. And they're putting tactical nukes into conventional forces with a military doctrine called escalate to de-escalate. So if you're losing conventionally, you throw some tactical nukes and then you de-escalate. That's nuts. If you read Daniel Ellsberg's book, The Doomsday Machine, once the nukes start flying, it's like an automatic machine. They all fly. And that's the end of us. So what I've been saying is we need nuclear disarmament initiatives. We need to pledge no first use, disarm to a minimum credible deterrent, cut back our military spending, I'm saying 75%, get out of these proxy wars around the world. There are nine of them we're engaged in right now, special ops in over 100 countries. Bring our troops back from foreign bases and then go to the world on the basis of those tension-reducing initiatives and say we want complete and mutual disarmament. Like was agreed to by 122 nations when they agreed to the text in July 2017 of a treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons. And the International Campaign for the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons, which pushed that, got the Nobel Peace Prize for that in 2017. And hardly anybody in this country knows that, because the corporate state media doesn't cover the story and the major party political candidates aren't even addressing it. So that's another issue that I'm hoping our campaign can get into the debate and make the major party candidates deal with it.
What do you think the role of the military should be in the U.S.? Do you think they can serve some type of function if we, you know, cut something like military spending and we stopped some of these insane foreign policy initiatives and wars?
Well, I think we need a force to defend ourselves. The prospects of a conventional attack, invasion of the United States, are minimal. We got these two giant moats on either side. Mexico and Canada aren't going to launch an assault on us. So it's not going to cost that much. And then where, you know, through the UN, multilateral diplomacy, we should have maybe intervention when, you know, there's genocide going on or aggression by one country against another, against the UN Charter. And we could contribute troops to that. So there's a role, but it's much smaller than we have now. And then dealing with this coronavirus crisis, the Defense Production Act, Trump signed it, but he didn't use it. I mean, we should do what we did during World War II when they had the War Production Board and they took over or built a quarter of the manufacturing capacity of the country in order to turn industry on a dime into what they called the arsenal of democracy to arm the U.S., the U.K., and Russia to defeat the Nazis. And we should be doing the same thing now to produce and get the supply chains up for that production and distribute the medical supplies we need and get this test, contact, trace, and quarantine program going so we can go back to work safely. And, you know, Trump is just letting, you know, private business, you know, take advantage of short supply to price gouge. And you know, we're not, our needs are not being met. Now, the military, they know logistics. You know, General Honoré, you know, that worked on the Katrina thing. Man, he should be in charge, not Trump. And he would know what to do, or he'd know what generals, you know, what people to get. And there's private industry could do that. I mean, I worked for UPS, you know, unloading trucks for 20 years. Their thing is logistics. You know, they would help. Instead, you know, they're just letting the market do it, and the states are on their own, and they're bidding against each other for these scarce supplies that aren't even being produced in the quantity we need. And or we're dependent on foreign sources who need it for their own coronavirus problem. So, you know, that's a big mess.
You know, just a few more things I wanted to touch on. One issue that's very important to me because I've done coverage of it is the issue of police brutality. And also, I mean, I think we're in a point, we're at a point in this country where the police are more and more militarized. What do you think about the issue of policing in America?
Well, a number of things. I wrote an 8,000 word essay on community control to the police because, you know, crime rates have dropped steadily for 30 years, but the number of police killings has remained constant. It's almost like clockwork, about 1,000 a year. And that's, they're militarized. You know, police are here to serve and protect. They should be peacekeepers, not an occupying force. The idea of community control is that we get police that serve us. Instead of, you know, I just take my city of Syracuse as an example. We've been under a federal consent decree to desegregate the police. And they're still over 90% white and live 90% outside the city in a city that's half people of color. And we keep getting these judgments in court against police brutality that cost the city a lot. They're not serving and protecting us. They're a force unto themselves. And they are draining the city budget. So we need community control. Now, what was done, you know, the demand for community control was raised by the Black Panther Party in 1970. In Berkeley, they had a referendum, and then they had a big conference in 1973. But instead of that, we went with review boards, which have various degrees of power, but mostly discipline still done within departments, investigations still done within departments, and the review board is like, you know, can make some recommendations. In some cases, they can't even subpoena witnesses or compel the police to testify in cases. They haven't done the job. So I think that's part of it. And then when you have community control, you can clean house. There are a lot of cops that are racist. We see that on Facebook posts, and you hear it. I mean, I heard it through the Teamsters, through people, you know, out in those rural areas, you know, what they'd say about us in the city, in the bars, you know, after work. And it wasn't pretty. And we had that incident at the Border Patrol in their Facebook post, where half the Border Patrol is on this Facebook page and they're talking racist stuff about the immigrants, you know. So I think Border Patrol and ICE, we need to just like fire them all, have a new agency, and then those people can reapply, but they're going to be vetted. And same thing we got to do in the police departments. And then we need to reorient what the police do. I think Richmond, California is a good example to look at. We had a green mayor there named Gail McLaughlin. She was elected in 2004, and she hired this guy, Chris Magnus, who was a gay white guy from Fargo, North Dakota, policeman. And it's a city that's 80% people of color. And a lot of people said, what did they hire him for? But he had an idea that instead of promoting cops based on arrests and tickets, we're going to promote them based on relationships built and problems solved. And every officer was assigned to a neighborhood beat where they're supposed to get to know the people and the businesses. And a lot of those cops quit. You know, they were Iraq war veterans. They're used to search and destroy. You know, that's the way they saw their job. So he was able to replace the force. It went from 20% to 60% people of color, a lot of women. He got the replace of the lieutenants and captains, 41 out of 44. And the murder rate in that city was one of the highest in the country. City of about 100,000, they'd have over 40 murders a year for years. It went down to 7 from, I think, 44 the first year to 7 after 8 years. And so the other thing they did was they targeted the youth in the gangs that were doing most of the shootings. And they said, we know what you're doing, and if you keep doing it, there's going to be consequences, but we're going to give you some opportunities. One was a $1,000 a month stipend, which a philanthropist provided. You stay out of trouble, you get $1,000 a month. And then they gave them counseling, job references, job training, drug treatment, the things they needed. And so a lot of those young people got into a better path. That's the kind of approach, because underlying the crime, which the police are fighting is, you know, poverty and inequality. And so, you know, it's like the drug war. Instead of dealing as a criminal problem, you got to deal with it as a health problem. In terms of street crime, you got to deal with the underlying causes of street crime. And that's dealing with the problem of poverty and economic despair. So those are some of my thoughts on that. And, you know, the federal government should stop selling surplus military equipment to police departments. You know, we got troop carriers here in Syracuse that I don't know what they're going to use them for. But I remember in the city council, some of the council was saying, what are we getting this for? And the police department said, well, it's free. Might as well. But the thing is, once you get it, you got to maintain it. And that costs.
Before we start wrapping up, you mentioned a few times in passing the Green New Deal, which you're one of the architects of the original Green New Deal. What is the difference between what you want to do with a Green New Deal as opposed to, say, an Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez? And also, I guess, tied into that, one of the concepts that you are very supportive of, I believe, is eco-socialism. Maybe we could tie those two questions together.
Yeah, I call my Green New Deal now the eco-socialist Green New Deal because the Democrats took the brand and diluted the content. You know, that became the signature issue of the Green Party. I ran out in 2010. In fact, by the end of that campaign, we had 62 Greens around the country. We had a federal version of it that we signed on to the statement. Jill Stein, that was a theme of her campaign when she ran for president for the Green Party in 2012 and 2016. Then in 2018, they had the sit-in at Pelosi's office with the Sunrise Movement and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez there. And they were demanding a select committee for a Green New Deal. And Pelosi wasn't having any of that because it could put legislation right on the floor. So AOC and Senator Ed Markey came back with a non-binding Green New Deal, just trying to get a vote, get a sentiment of the House and the Senate. And they left out really important parts, like the ban on fracking and new fossil fuel infrastructure. If we don't win that demand, they're going to build out this infrastructure and we're going to be burning fossil fuels for decades and the planet is done. They left out deep cuts in military spending to help fund this Green New Deal. And they extended the deadline from 2030 to get to 100% clean energy to 2050. And even then, Pelosi wouldn't let them vote on it in the House. Never voted on it. Now, McConnell said, oh, we want you to vote on it because half you Democrats in the Senate are running for president. We want to put you on the record. And Markey and Schumer said, oh, that's a trick. We're going to vote present. And all the Democrats did, except four of them, voted with the Republicans, no, on the Green New Deal. So we're not going to get a Green New Deal from the Democrats. That's pretty clear. Now, when I say eco-socialist, what we got to do, we can't do this in the time frame we're talking about, a decade, to get to zero to negative greenhouse gas emissions and 100% clean energy. And we had that timeline because that's what the carbon budgets that the climate scientists have given us to avoid the worst impacts of climate change, what we got to do in rich countries like the United States. So we can't do that with a carbon tax and some regulations here and some mandates there, which the industries will fight and gum up. What we need is public energy, a public energy system, the utilities and the Exxon Mobils and Koch brothers who are not going to reinvest their earnings in renewables. We need to reinvest those earnings from fossil fuels, which we'll use during the transition, into renewables. We need public transportation. The railroads, freight, passenger, and the airlines should be part of a, you know, national public transportation corporation that rebuilds our rails on an electrified basis. More freight rails. High-speed bullet trains between the cities, which reduces the need for air traffic for intermediate and short-range air flights. And the light rail trolleys that every city in this country had between the 1890s and the 1930s. And then manufacturing. We need to do what we did during World War II when the federal government took over a quarter of the manufacturing capacity. We need to rebuild our manufacturing so we can build clean factories that have zero waste as well as are powered by clean energy. And zero waste is important because we have huge other environmental problems, toxic waste, plastic pollution, and so forth. So zero waste means all the byproducts in the production process are recycled, and products, when they're used up, are returned to the manufacturer for recycling. And so We hardly have a machine tool industry in this country. We got to rebuild that. You need that to build the machinery for the production of intermediate goods and consumer goods. So we're talking about things like replacing coke oven with furnaces, with electric arc furnaces for steel production, making cement without heating up calcium carbonate. Calcium hardens the cement. The carbonate goes into the atmosphere as carbon dioxide and heats it up. That's 5% of the world's carbon footprint. So we need a new way of manufacturing cement. There are ways to do it. We just got to scale them up. Plastics. We need to totally change our plastics industry so that plastics are biodegradable. We use agricultural feedstocks, carbohydrates instead of hydrocarbons. Because the reason plastics are not biodegradable is they are new chemicals. There's no enzymes in nature to break down. So that's, I mean, we can go through all the technologies, but that's what we've got to do. And it's got to be done through the public sector. Like we had an officer war mobilization during the World War II, now we need an officer climate mobilization to plan the public sector transformation and coordinate all the federal agencies around this emergency program. So that's why we call it an eco-socialist Green New Deal. Now, the only one that had a serious program of the Democrats was Bernie Sanders. He brought back in his Green New Deal the ban on fracking and new fossil fuel infrastructure, the phase out of nuclear power. He mentioned deep cuts in military spending without saying how much. And then his bill or his plan was $16.3 trillion over 10 years. The plan I've detailed, you can go to my website, howiehawkins.us, and look at it, is $27 trillion over 10 years to transform the economy. Bernie, I think the only difference between him and us, because his numbers seem to come out where we do on these different programs, is that he's got a timeline till 2050 instead of 2030. He's 2030 for transportation and energy, which is over half of the carbon footprint, but he still takes longer for manufacturing, agriculture, and buildings. And we want to do that by 2030. And then the other Democrats, I mean, they're $1 to $3 trillion over 10 years, and it's mostly subsidies to the vested interests and some mandates here and regulations there, and they're not serious. So that's the, you know, the full-strength Green New Deal that I'm talking about.
I have to say I'm glad you mentioned the bullet trains, because no one talks about that, and yet it seems to be something that works well in certain foreign countries. I believe China uses them. Were you going to say something, Casey?
Yeah, I was just going to add, I'm glad that you brought up agriculture as being a key component of the Green New Deal. And I was wondering if you could go into greater depth about the Green Party's platform with regards to rural America and revitalizing that aspect of American life that over the past 10 to 20 years has been battered down by the by capital, has led to the use of like vast industrial farming. Well, what's the Green Party's position with regards to that?
Well, we want to replace corporate, chemicalized, industrialized agriculture with real farmers that own their farms. A lot of these farmers are now tenant farmers. They're working for corporations. And even if they still own their land, they're dependent on, you know, seeds from Monsanto that they can't keep seed for the next crop. They got to go back to Monsanto. And we're talking about eliminating all the biocides, you know, pesticides and herbicides from agriculture, and with subsidies for farmers to convert to regenerative organic agriculture, because it's healthier, safer for the environment, for the farmers and farm workers, for the food we get. And as you rebuild soil, you draw carbon out of the atmosphere, so it helps with the climate issue. In order to make sure farmers can earn a living income above their production costs, we want to have full parity pricing for all agricultural commodities. We do have price supports for things like, you know, the big commodities, corn, cotton, soy. But we want it for all the agricultural commodities, all the fruits and vegetables, all the grains, all the dairy. And also have supply management programs so we don't get gluts in some markets and shortages in others. And this will help stabilize, you know, the prices farmers get. And of course, insurance in case of, you know, bad weather and a failed crop. And the other thing we want to do for rural America is then build these Green New Deal factories in these small towns and cities that have lost their manufacturing. and use the feedstocks from agricultural products for the products we produce in these factories. Like, you know, hemp is now legal. That should come back big way. It makes great cloths, paper, food products, and that can be produced right in the region where the hemp is grown. And same with other agricultural products. So it's sort of bringing city and country back together and integrating them. In rural America, which has been neglected, you know, farmers are going out of business, you know, dairy farmers in Wisconsin and up here in New York. And, you know, the farmers that have these, you know, big, you know, farms for corn and soy and cotton, you know, they are becoming more and more dependent on corporate farming. So we get corporate agriculture out. We're only working farmers on the land. And then we need a homestead program to put more farmers on the land, because if we go organic, we're going to need about 1 million more farmers. And I think a good source of those people, because people in the cities mostly aren't thinking about becoming farmers. Even the children of farm families in this corporate atmosphere are not so interested. But the people who are interested are the former farmers from Mexico, Guatemala, and Central America, because that's what they were doing before, between NAFTA and coups and whatnot. We forced them off their land. And I work here with the Worker Center in Central New York. These are mostly Spanish-speaking farm workers from Mexico and Central America. And their dream is to have a farm. They now do the work. You know, they do the, you know, they milk the cows, they pick the crops. But what they'd really like to do is be farmers. And I think, you know, we should help them get on the land as land becomes available as we move out to corporate farmers.
If I could, Howie, one last question, and then I'll let you go. I know you're very busy, but I have to ask you, you know, there's a lot of people now, more and more, that I think for years were propagandized with this idea, oh, the left is bad. You know, the right sort of has tried to say that anyone on the left or that's progressive, oh, these godless communists and all this BS. And I think for a long time, people bought into that BS. There's a lot of people that have bought into that BS. But more and more now, I notice people that were to the right economically saying to me, you know, maybe the Green Party has a point. Maybe Bernie Sanders has a point. And it's they're getting closer to saying, you know, something has to be done. And it's not going to be the private sector that does it when it comes to things like healthcare or global warming and climate catastrophe. People are starting to make the leap. What would you say to those people that are close to saying, you know, I think we need to embrace progressive and left values, but are still on the fence? I'm not talking about the people who already support the Green Party or support Bernie Sanders, but those people who are getting close to supporting it, but they're just not there yet. They need that little push.
Well, I'd say three things about that. One is, socialism is now a conversation starter, where it used to be a conversation stopper. And I think Bernie Sanders has helped with that. I think Fox News has helped with that by calling Obama a socialist. And a lot of Obama people are saying, well, if he's a socialist, you know, maybe I am, and even though he was anything but. So I think that whole conversation is open, particularly with younger people who didn't grow up, you know, in the Cold War, in the Red Scare. So I think it's opened up an opportunity to talk about, you know, what socialism is. And I think, you know, socialists concerned with, you know, I mean, conservatives concerned with getting results, like on healthcare, or dealing with this coronavirus crisis. I mean, it's really clear that the public sector, now's the time when we need it. And this idea that government can do nothing, well, the private sector is totally blowing how we're responding to the coronavirus crisis. You know, Trump is making that clear for even conservatives to see. And, you know, I think, and there's literature on political psychology and so forth, where, you know, some people are temperamentally conservative and some are temperamentally progressive. The conservatives temperamentally think, don't touch anything, you might make it worse. And the progressives are like, we can fix that. And you kind of need both people in a group to, like, you know,
you cut out for a second.
Okay,
you cut out for a second. You said the progressives, and then you cut off.
Okay, progressives are like, we can fix this, you know, let's do something. And the conservatives are like, don't touch it, you might make it worse. And those are like temperaments. But when you get to ideology, you know, the idea that government can't do anything, you know, it's been exposed in this coronavirus crisis. I think when we talk about health care, you know, majority of people who had called themselves conservatives think Medicare for All is a pretty good idea. So when you get below the labels and you talk about real solutions, practical solutions, people who call themselves conservative and call themselves progressive often come to the same conclusion because it's obvious. I mean, if I got time for an example, back when we started the Clamshell Alliance and these occupations, it was a last resort. We've been fighting this nuke. We're going to occupy the site. 8% of the people in public opinion polls were with us. We didn't want to build this nuke. We got people's attention with the occupation, but then we went out to town meetings and said, we got to stop construction works in progress, which meant the ratepayers were paying for the thing as it was built instead of after it was built, which is a traditional way. And back then, New Hampshire was very conservative. You know, Manchester Union Leader readers, Rock Rib Republicans. And we bring these resolutions to town meeting, and these conservative people would say, yeah, why should we pay for this thing when we don't even know it's going to work? And we explained, you know, how Wall Street was trying to make a lot of money off this, and the public service company in New Hampshire was investing, I forget what it was, like 100 times more money than their total assets to build this one nuke. And these conservatives were saying, this is crazy. We're with you. And so up and down the state, hundreds of towns, we voted against construction works in progress. And 2 years later, 80% of New Hampshire was opposed to the Seabrook nuclear power plant. And that's not because we made the conservatives into progressives. It's because in that particular problem, there was a solution that both progressives and conservatives saw was obvious. We weren't going to pay for this thing, even before we even knew it would work. So I think when you get below the labels and talk about, you know, practical solutions, you know, whatever people's temperaments are, or a lot of, you know, Republicans are traditionally Republicans because their parents were. Same with Democrats. So, you know, and they don't think too much about the labels. It's just like, that's what they are. I mean, I live in a mostly black neighborhood here, and a lot of people vote for me, but they're not going to switch to the Green Party because they say, I don't want to have to explain myself to my neighbors and my family. You know, black people are Democrats. And mostly that's defensive because the Republicans to them look like the Ku Klux Klan. So I think that gets back to organizing. You got to stop broadcasting to people only through social media or whatever media and go talk to people and get to know them and let them get to know you. And then you got a relationship, and then you can talk things through.
All I would add to that is I like that you said listening to people, because I know some younger leftists that they want to sort of browbeat people. And I get why. Like, you just want to, you know, yell sometimes and be like, oh, why can't we do it this way? But we do have to listen to each other and understand the necessity of solidarity and listening to each other out.
Yeah. And if we want to win, we're going to have to win people over. And that requires a conversation and patience. But as somebody said about the Chilean Revolution, we have to make haste slowly. In other words, we got to move, but we got to move in the right way. And, you know, these life and death issues we've been talking about, we're running out of time. Climate, the arms race. And for a lot of working class people, inequalities, the immediate issue.
Well, Howie Hawkins, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views. I love that your campaign is gaining a lot of steam. I heard that you may be doing a Michael Isikoff's podcast at some point in the future. So you're really gaining steam. How can my listeners keep up with your campaign?
Well, I was already on Michael Isikoff, but he said, we'll do it again. So maybe you know something about coming up that I don't yet. But yeah, I'd be happy to go back on his podcast. Well, the best way to get in touch with my campaign is my campaign website. And it's HowieHawkins.us. HowieHawkins.us, like United States. And from there, you can, you know, see what we're saying, more about what we're saying. There's a lot of written material up there. You can volunteer. You can get on a list to get bulletins from the campaign about what we're doing. You can donate. You can link to Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and all that other social media. So that's the best place to go, HowieHawkins.us.
And Casey, if you want to lead us out for this episode.
Stay safe. Stay strong, stay at least 2 meters apart, solidarity forever.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Howie Hawkins, the NOTA activist and organizer now running for president under the Green Party ticket. I, for one, think Howie provided some food for thought in our conversation. But let me know what you think by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@protonmail.com. Also, if you can, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/ParallaxViews. That's patreon.com/ParallaxViews, where you can get all kinds of bonus content, including some video interviews of the shows we do on Parallax Views, as well as older editions of the show that are only available now to Patreon supporters. All that and more on the Parallax Views Patreon, including the Parallax Views current events and rambling about pop culture show The Week That Was, with your hosts JG, yours truly, and Casey. So all that to be found on the Parallax Views Patreon. That's patreon.com/ParallaxViews. I do this full time, so I need all the support I can get. I realize that these are tough times economically, so only offer that support to me if you absolutely can. And for those that do offer that support, thank you so, so much. It means the world. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.